You are listening to the Furler Bros Tech Podcast, episode 282, The Future of Facebook News and the Demise of Wikipedia. Season 7, episode 282 of the Furler Bros Tech Podcast. Today is February the 19th, 2017. I'm Matthew Dean Furler, and not flying home from China today is my brother James Furler.
So, it's not really the 19th, is it, for you?
It's not raining, you said?
The 19th.
No, it is the 19th.
Oh. Oh, okay.
It's Sunday the 19th, man. It's already Sunday morning. I have one of those weird days where I'm going to take
Wait, off. Did you say... I'm sorry. Did you say 19th or 18th?
It's the 19th.
Okay. It's the 18th for me.
I know.
What it is... but I'm... Here's what's throwing me off is for our record date, we wrote the 19th, which is why I was like, wait, shouldn't you be a day ahead? Shouldn't it be the 20th? And then, then the second time you said it, I looked at my actual clock and I went, oh, no, it's the 18th. He's right. I just...
Okay.
It's me. Sorry, man.
No, it's all right. I'm sick of this. I have one of those weird days. The flight going from China to America is always so weird because I take off at 1:45 p.m. today, and then I land at 9 a.m. today.
Right.
Which is time travel for those of you who are wondering. I get a full, but this is the real issue. So I woke up at a normal, I went to bed at a normal time last night. I woke up at a normal time today, which means that about, you know, my flight's going to be like 12, 13 hours. So about the time I'm landing, I'll be like an hour or two past my normal bedtime. So as I'm landing, I'll just be getting tired enough to go to sleep for the night. And
perfect.
Then I'll have the entire day that I need to stay up for. this is gonna be one of the worst jet lag days of my life. I can already tell.
I was reading on Lifehacker, and I probably should have shared this with you ahead of time, but they were saying one of the tricks you can do to try to offset it is to just change when you eat. Eat on the new time. You don't necessarily have to change your sleep, but just eating is enough to trigger your body to be like, oh yeah, we're good.
Interesting. It'll be yeah, probably too late.
You're welcome.
You know, it's and the worst part is like everybody I talk to and I've experienced this myself, going east to west is worse than going west to east. And on top of it,
yeah, true.
This, like the timing is just terrible. And because I'm not working when I get, you know, it's like I don't have anything to stay up for. So if I take a nap, which I probably will, it's just going to be, it's going to be bad, James. It's going to be, jet lag's going to take weeks to get over. I can already tell.
Do you have to work on Monday? It's President's Day, so maybe not.
Nah, I do. I'm That's working good. On Monday. Yeah,
oh, you are?
Yeah, that helps a little. Yeah, no, exactly. It's going to be a fun ride, James. It's going to be a fun ride. I'm excited.
There's this thing called video conferences and telephones. I don't know if you've heard of those. It makes it so that you don't have to go somewhere. You can just talk to them.
Yeah. Wait. What do you mean?
I'm just saying you don't have to do this travel thing anymore. They've solved that problem.
Yeah. See, the thing is that I'm in an industry where I don't go places to have conversations. I go places to build things, and that is something that you can't quite do from home. There's not, the telepresence isn't quite there yet for robotics. I'm hoping it will be by the time my career is over, but you know.
Well, it sounds like you found a problem you can solve.
Yeah, at the present, I still need to, if dials need to be turned and buttons need to be pressed, I still need to go and press and turn the dials, tighten some screws, you know, do that sort of thing.
Yeah, you need an avatar. That's what you need.
I've been
to
pretty
send
cool.
there and do your work for you, and then when you're done, you just unplug.
Yeah, I will say this: one thing I'm really excited about going back home is unlimited Google. I'm really tired of having to. Yeah, I have to go through my T-Mobile in order to get Google, which isn't fast enough to actually do like YouTube or any Google services like that take any real heft. Like I can Google things, but
so how are we doing this right now?
Over LTE, it's kind of a. Okay. Like, I can't do... So this is what's funny. So normally, as you know, for this, a little bit of tech background, as you know, we have a Google Doc that we share all of the information on, and mm-hmm. then we do a Google Hangout, which we publish mm-hmm. simultaneously to YouTube. I can really only do one of those things at a time. So I had to copy and paste all of my Google... everything from our Google document into an iCloud Notes document because I have a Raspberry Pi hooked up to the hotel TV and on that, and that's hooked up to Wi-Fi, where I can access the iCloud Notes over Wi-Fi, but I can't access the Google Docs over Wi-Fi. So I'm just sort of...
Totally. We could use like Dropbox paper or something.
Honestly, everything else is so complicated that I feel like setting it up. This is one of those, like, it's good enough, James. It's good enough. Don't.
Okay.
I'm walking off. I've managed to keep everything balanced while I was here, and I have just enough access, but I'm ready to go home and have my internet universe continue to work properly and easily. It's going to be nice. China. Get your act together. It's nice that Apple's got the stuff figured out here, though. I appreciate.
Did you at least see some cool sites? Did you see a wall that's pretty great? Anything like that?
I didn't leave Shanghai, which is larger than most states in America. So, or population wise, so there's plenty to see here. But yeah, I got to see. Trekked all around. Shanghai. Got to see different neighborhoods. Got to see different sites and
neighborhoods.
Try different food and stuff. But you got to think of these neighborhoods. There are neighborhoods here that are as big as some of the biggest cities in America. I mean, it's amazing how the scale of this city. So, you know, it's 25 million.
So my wife and I will never be going there because she gets claustrophobic in Portland.
Yeah, this is an endless sea of humanity, which, it's funny. I will say this. There are many cities that I travel to. I always get this like wistful feeling as I'm leaving, wishing I could have spent more time there. For whatever mm-hmm. reason, in Shanghai, I don't get that feeling quite as much. And I know some people do, but I just and it's funny because it's not even the size of the city to me. It's because I get this wistful feeling to go back to Hong Kong, which you think wouldn't be that different, but it feels different, man. It feels different. And one of the biggest problems that I have, though, and I think this solving this problem would help a lot, is there is a serious language barrier. Like I am really. I am an island of communication all on my own when I'm here, which is kind of terrifying. Yeah, there's most people here know as much English as I know Chinese. So it's like we can say hello and thank you to each other in either language.
Wow.
Yeah, it's
that makes it difficult. Even taxi drivers, yeah. Huh?
Oh, especially taxi drivers. I literally have a piece of paper in my wallet with names of important places like my hotel so that I can just point to it. And if I ever got lost and were like needed to get a taxi back to the hotel, that was like my escape. I will say the subway system is actually really easy, though. Once you kind of do it once or twice, there's if you've got Google Maps and you can kind of look where you need to go, the taxi, or I mean the subway, is actually really convenient for somebody who only speaks English, but
that's interesting because I know in Indonesia, like the taxi cabs drivers, they all spoke four or five different languages, and
because
they want to be able to speak to their passengers. but
which makes sense to me.
Vacation place versus a city.
When you say, well, it comes back to the whole, you know, China or Shanghai is 25 million people, and not only do they all speak Mandarin, but a lot of them, most of them do speak multiple languages, is what I'm finding out. It's just English isn't one of those languages.
Oh, huh.
So, you know, it's my job to learn Mandarin if I want to come back here on my own. Or I can just
try to talk Jesse into my kids.
Yeah. Working on Italian right now. Not sure about
that. You excited to get back to those classes? Because you've been skipping out on that too, right?
So it's actually been my primary, like, keep my brain stretching thing that I've been doing while I've been here, because most of my engineering tools are at home. So I've just been studying Italian.
Cool.
A lot of Duolingo. It's a pretty fun little app. Mm-hmm. I find that it's not very good if you're learning on your own, but as a supplementary practice app, it's pretty awesome actually.
Huh, fascinating.
It's good times. Good time. James, you know what? We're not here to talk about China. Kind of, I guess, in a roundabout sort of way. But this week, like every
just
week,
anytime we'll be we talk about hardware.
Exactly. We'll be talking about technology and the continuing corporate opera, and by that we mean the soap opera of corporations' dealings back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and of course the technology they're developing. But before we get into the heart of the show, James got a short disclosure he wants to throw our way.
I founded and work for HPI. However, I do not represent HPI or any of their opinions. I also own part of Twitter, Etsy, and Lending Club.
Nice. If you want to follow us throughout the week, check out any of the photos that I've posted, including the tool that I came here to set up. You can follow me on Instagram. Yeah, next week.
A tool isn't the right way to describe that.
You know, it's funny because it's like, that's the term, that's the industry term that we use. They're all tools, but it does conjure the idea of like a handheld power tool, whereas... That is, yeah,
this is more like the bus I installed.
Yeah, it's actually pretty weight wise. It's closer to that than a drill. I'll say that.
Yeah.
it's pretty enormous and, it's interesting stuff. It's fun. It's a unique little system, but yeah, check it out. My Instagram is nextwiggin4, nextwiggin, and then the number 4, or you can follow me on the Twitter, where I'll share my thoughts, which is, @MatthewDFurlow.
Something. I am @JamesFurlow on Twitter, James Furlow, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, everywhere, but Snapchat. So you can follow me there.
He's consistent in his branding. If you want to know more about the show, go to furloughbros.com. Everything that we talked about this week, all the links will be there. So if we talk about any videos or anything, audio, stuff like that, or you just want to read deeper, go and check it out. It's a great little synopsis of the week's events in tech. We curated it for you because we're responsible journalists. And go to I bring that up because we're going to be talking about that more. What was it?
I think what you meant to say was we've curated the best list ever in the world.
Oh man, jeez. I was trying to avoid that.
Oh.
I was trying to skirt that, I should say. Maybe is
trying not to be sensational.
Yes, exactly.
Well, me too. So we're good.
And but if you want to, what's really nice about that is that that entire document we will send to your email every week if you just want to get it freshly delivered, and just go to the website, sign up, and take a look. See, it's pretty nice. Pretty nice little chunk of information.
It's amazing.
It's a bigly.
Bigly, yes.
But. Yeah, I like it.
You're up, dog.
I am? All right. Oh, yeah, that's right.
I have to tell you this because I'm sure you can't see any of my articles.
No, I actually, I did copy and paste everything. So I got your articles too. Well, what's really funny is that when you copy and paste from Google Docs into iCloud, it doesn't copy the links. So I have the list of all the articles, and then separately I have the links that I can. It's just, it's overly complicated, man. Anyway,
Dropbox paper. So,
no.
It's all good.
You got a system. So neither one of us are single, so this is only passing. It's only useful in a curious sort of way, but for those single listeners, this is important. Go buy yourself a new iPhone. it's important.
Oh.
Just trust me. So you may not think you're being judged by your phone, or maybe you think it's wrong that you're being judged by your phone, but you are. There was a study.
Since I'm on the iPhone side, I'm totally cool with it.
And a study conducted by Match.com and Research Now decided, they found out that iPhone owners are about 21 times more likely to negatively judge a date who uses an Android phone. On the flip side, Android owners are only 15 times as likely to negatively judge a date for opting for iOS. So
that's so not surprising.
I know. So basically, it's a people are judgy about your phones, but iPhone owners are more judgy. but this is the.
Well, I don't hold back. I'm more than willing to make fun of Android users.
Right. Well, and it's I
and then there are times when I have to lie about my. Oh yeah, everything's great. It works fine. It's wonderful.
Oh yeah, everything does just work all the time.
It's great.
Yeah,
Touch ID gets it perfect every time. Siri, it's amazing.
I know. It's just, it's super useful. I never have to repeat anything twice. I never get really frustrated when I can't do super simple tasks that other competitors can do.
Yeah, it's good. iPhones are great.
It's perfect. But
my favorite feature really is getting to do the VR on my iPhone. I love that part.
Oh yeah, man. Yeah, especially when they install the hardware to make AR possible, and then immediately give developers access to those APIs so that you can create all sorts of sophisticated augmented reality apps, which are just
great.
I know.
So much better than Android. There are days, and I got a confession to make. So I was gluing down a floor today. I have just a little bit on my toe. It's killing me. I can't get rid of it, though. All right. Got that out of my system. It's like my toes are sticking, just like they're tacky now. Anyways.
Oh, that's terrible.
That wasn't what I... there are some weeks where I'm like, I would like to switch to Android. This was one of those weeks. I don't know why, but it's not that I was upset about my iPhone, because I do genuinely like it. But it's like I saw an ad or I saw something and I was like, dude, that just looks cool. I would like one of those.
It's, honestly, it's the Google VR stuff, man. There's a bunch of, I've become such a basketball fan, it blows my mind sometimes. But the NBA put out a VR app this last week that's only accessible on Google Daydream. And I'm just like, oh, I want that. I want that so bad.
There's a solution.
I know, and I'm just, and more and more of the Tango phones are coming out, more and more Daydream phones are coming out.
I think part of my problem, too, is like the rumors are starting to fly for the next version of iPhone, and I'm like, okay, big deal. What about this is compelling? But maybe that's my other problem.
What rumors in particular are you
doing? Well, they're like, it's going to be an OLED screen, and they're going to get rid of the button, and blah, blah, blah.
It's a really big deal to people. Okay.
But why?
but why? Honestly, it reminds me of when video games would come out with better graphics, and people would go out and buy, they would buy video game systems and games based on how good the graphics looked. And I was always in the camp of, look, if the game isn't as fun, but it looks better, I don't care. The graphics will wear off way faster. But it matters to people, and obviously these systems became hugely successful based on that. And I think, especially with like the OLED thing, what the advantage of that is, it gives you an even bigger screen without growing the body of the phone. So the phone doesn't become bigger, but you get a bigger screen, which leads more credence to my belief that phones are the worst possible size. They're too small to be useful and too big to be mobile. That's why people want it. It's because they want a bigger screen, but they don't want the phone to be any bigger. And that's what gets people excited.
For me, it's like, that's going to be the focus. And whereas, like, you look on the Android camp, and like, now we're doing VR, and screens are good. And
I still think that the whole point of putting dual cameras on the, the primary feature that Apple is currently selling the iPhone 7 on is the bokeh effect, which is an augmented reality depth of field thing. What I'm saying is they are currently internally developing the API for augmented reality, and they're testing it in real world use cases. I'm willing to bet that if they don't launch AR API at WWDC, they're setting the groundwork to do it when the iPhone 8 or 10 or whatever comes out. But I can easily see them say, oh, we're going to give third-party developers access to the beginning of these tools to use both lenses at the same time, like we're doing. That wouldn't shock me at all, especially because Tim Cook is such a big, outspoken advocate of AR right now. Like, he keeps talking about it. They've already got the hardware, so they're not going to be ruining any surprises. And they've got they just announced WWDC.
Yeah.
Tim Cook is going on and on about it. I could easily see them make an announcement that gets everybody excited and starts the drums banging towards the iPhone 10 or 8 or 7S or whatever name they're gonna call
it. Whatever it is. I get that. I don't know. I guess the other thing that I'm quasi annoyed about is I've been using Alexa for a while now, and it's awesome. And the solution was so easy. It's Alexa, ask the name of an app to do something for me. And I'm like, that was such an easy solution, and it annoys me that Apple like didn't figure that out. And Siri, like, you can throw all sorts of requests at it, or you can throw the same request at it a bunch of different ways, and it'll still handle it. And like, that's fantastic. But relative to all the things that Alexa can do, and I get it. Like, there are times when I'll ask Alexa to do something, and it'll be like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, yeah, you do. And then I'll look it up and go, oh, I said the wrong word. Sorry. And then I'll say it again, and she'll get it right. So, like, it's not perfect, but I'm just annoyed by that. And just going, I would like them to fix that, which I get. Like, that's not a hardware issue. That's a software issue. And to some extent, the AR or VR is also a software issue at this point, not a hardware issue. But I want more. I want more.
I think
they can deliver, and I'm not confident they can. So I find myself looking over at the Android camp going, could they deliver? Which, at this point, no, for what I'm looking for. Whatever, I'm going to stick with it. But
that's the frustrating part to me, is it's like, is you look over, and I still come back to, I really like my Apple Watch, and there's nothing like on that. The Android side that even comes close to that. And
dude, I'm on track to complete all my rings this month.
This week or this month? Oh, nice.
Month. Come on, dude.
How many what's your active calories that you need?
Dude, a number, don't worry about it.
Oh, see. Okay.
It's 400.
Impress me when, it's what?
400.
Oh, man.
Chopping. Hey, I have an office job. I sit a lot, okay?
Yeah, me too.
That's different.
Saying, I completed every ring, and for an entire month at 770. Actually, I did it for 3 months. I just didn't get credit for it because Apple, because of ridiculous stuff. One time.
Is that going to happen again to you?
Not this month. I'm not on track to do it this month. I blew it early on. But I knew I was traveling this month, so it kind of was like okay with it. Because, and for those of you who are wondering what I'm talking about, when I travel today, I'm going to lose 13 hours. And for whatever reason, at least this is how the software was set up last year, even if I had completed my workout ring prior to, well, I wouldn't have been able to get like the standing bowl, which is driving me nuts. But even if I got like the workout ring and then I landed and I got the time switch, like it wouldn't give me credit for it. It was so awful.
Yeah. Like not only does it, so it doesn't just keep going for this day. Like it gave it for you for yesterday or something like that. It was weird. I remember, but
yeah, it's weird stuff, but okay. This is the last point I want to make. Bringing it back around, obviously we're conflicted on the whole who would we date, whether they have an Android or iPhone, but this is the important
stuff. I'm not conflicted about
nobody,
that just for the record
points. Nobody likes it if you have a cracked screen. The same study found that women are 86% more likely to negatively judge a date for having a broken smartphone screen. So if you're an Android-toting, cracked screen-having dude that just loves living on the edge of gadget acceptability, maybe consider a dumb phone for when you want to go out.
Wow.
Yeah. Which
I am not surprised by that, but wow.
I look at people with a cracked screen, and I was like, I wouldn't say I judge them negatively, but like if I had to really consider, well, okay, this is my problem. Some of the smartest people I know who are constantly fiddling with their phones have cracked screens because they're constantly fiddling with their phones and they're doing all sorts of crazy stuff. But so it's not necessarily a sign of somebody who just doesn't care. But I can totally see how people would take it as a sign of someone who just doesn't care.
Well, you know, it's one of those, like, if you're dating a lot of people, why take that particular risk, you know?
Yeah, exactly. You're looking for as many excuses to not like the person as excuses to like the person. Also, if you're really good looking, you probably don't have to worry about it. So let's just, you know.
It's true.
This is an edge case thing. If you're in the middle, then, you know, that's where you have to worry about it. But if you're beautiful or really ugly, whatever. Have fun.
I don't know, man. Even if she was really good looking and had a cracked screen, I'd think twice.
Really?
You just go, what's wrong with you? Like, what's wrong? Like, are you okay? I don't know. Especially if they don't address it. You know, it's one thing to be like, yeah, man, I broke it this morning. You're like, okay, yeah, I get it. You know, you can't replace it that fast. But if they're like, yeah, it's been like that for 6 months, I'm like, okay. Now this is like a point of pride, and I don't like that.
Yeah, well, it also, let's be honest, depends on how cracked. Like, I had a hairline crack through my... I had a single crack through my iPhone for, like, 6 months, but you could only really see it from some angles.
That's different.
The problem was it was actually more visible from an off angle. If you were looking directly at the phone, you could barely even see it. Whereas if you're talking about like a shattered screen where glass is falling off and when you swipe your finger, like you get little micro cuts. Yeah. Now that's that's a different situation. what's the deal? Just phones are cheap enough. Go get a new phone. So little dating advice, James, just helping out.
Appreciate it. It's good to know. I don't have a good transition for this. I want to talk about James Webb, if that's okay.
I'm okay with that. He's a good guy.
Okay. So, it probably is a person's name or a pair of people's names. But I don't know if you know this, but the Hubble Space Telescope is currently operating 12 years beyond its original 15-year lifespan. Did you know that?
That's pretty good.
It's almost twice as old as it's supposed to be.
I knew it was a lot. I didn't know it was that much older. I knew it was a lot older. older.
Yeah, yeah. So we all love it. Takes awesome pictures, but it's coming to an end. And honestly, it's even if it does continue to tick on, they're closing down the operations for it at the end of 2021. So we got like 4 more years, maybe, of Hubble Space Telescope. But here's the good news. It's being replaced.
Oh, nice. What's it being replaced with?
James Webb.
Oh, is that what it is? Okay.
Yeah, we're sending a dude up. No. So, the next telescope, which I gotta imagine we'll just call it the Webb telescope instead of the James Webb, but I don't know.
J-Dub.
Anyways, it is the official successor of Hubble, and there it's one of 5, actually, that's going up. And this dude, this telescope is a beast of a machine. Okay?
Yeah.
So, thing number one, it's not going to orbit the Earth like the Hubble does. Instead, whoa, it's going to orbit the Sun.
All right.
Yeah, why not? We're going to park it about 1.5 million miles away from the Earth in what they call the second Lagrange, or L2, for those of you who are cool. And so it'll stay on the dark side of Earth and orbit the Sun along with our planet.
Interesting.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So it's going to use the Earth to block the Sun, and it'll just kind of go with us.
Right. Somehow. So it'll be constantly eclipsed. It'll be in the shadow of, or it'll be in Earth's shadow, so it can actually take a picture towards the Sun, and
yeah,
and all it will miss is what Earth is covering up.
Right. Yeah, or I'll bet wait half a year and then get the other side. But yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
But
yeah.
So here's
that's an option, I guess.
Suppose. But here's what's also cool. They'll probably have some really cool eclipse pictures of the Earth just because. But
right.
Here's the other amazing things about this. So the Hubble's mirrors are 2.4 meters. Whereas okay. James Webb is 6.5 meters,
which it's makes a bit it over, bigger.
Yes, 5 times bigger. It's diameter. Mm. It's insane. So as a result, it will be able to detect objects that are 16 times fainter than the Hubble.
Okay. Whoa.
Yeah, it's crazy. The other really interesting part about it is that it's so big that it will actually need to be folded up for the launch. And then they're going to go through some process to unfold its 18 massive gold-plated mirrors. And that process is going to take about 5 months to do. It's insane. And it's far enough away that astronauts won't be able to go over and just, like, fix it. So, like, we really need to make sure that this thing works. Pretty crazy.
Well, I know that one of the design criteria of the Hubble was they wanted it to be something that could operate, that people could operate on. And so they, which actually ended up being a really good thing, because when it first launched, there was a flaw in the mirror that made it impossible to be able to really see anything that they wanted. So they did have to send astronauts up to fix the mirror after it was in orbit, yeah, on the Hubble. But the funny part was, well, I don't know if it's funny, but afterwards, they actually kind of took a step back and rethought about everything they were going through, and they decided that it actually would have been cheaper to design it and build it so that it wasn't human operatable, so that nobody could go up there and fix it, and just build a second one.
Wow.
They could have built 2 for the price of the one that a human could go and fix. So they one of the reasons why I'm sure they're doing this is that why, you know, when the design constraint is such that you don't have to worry about whether or not people can fix it, it allows you to do all sorts of crazy stuff, like put it into a much deeper orbit, and it costs less, and
yeah,
it's interesting. It's fascinating.
Yeah, stuff. So the other big difference, I should say, between the two of them is that Hubble was optimized for visible and ultraviolet light, whereas James Webb will mostly be in infrared light.
Kind of makes sense, I guess.
Allows them to more easily pass through debris and peer through gas and dust and see what's happening inside of them.
Well, it's so fascinating.
Yeah, and they also say it'll be able to peer deeper into the universe, seeing objects that formed only 100 million years after the Big Bang. So, who knows what we'll see. Pretty crazy. So that's the official replacement of the Hubble, which I think is nuts. There's a couple other. Let's see here. The next one is the Giant Magellan Telescope.
Cool, that sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's currently under construction. Where am I going with this? It's in construction at the Atacama Desert in Chile and will be expected to be done in 2025. Its mirrors are actually 24.5 meters in diameter.
That's pretty big, James. It's a pretty big.
80 mirror. Times that of the Hubble, 15 times of James Webb. It will weigh 15 tons.
What? That's huge. And they're going to put that in space.
and that one will do visible light. So it'll just be like regular mirrors. Let's see here. It will have about 10 times the resolving power of the Hubble, but since it's on the ground, pictures won't be quite as clear. So we kind of have that. But this is where it gets interesting. Because there's air that's constantly moving and warping light, right? And that's actually one of the reasons why stars appear to twinkle.
It's the atmosphere.
Which I didn't know that, but apparently that's true. So one of the things that they're doing is they've created what they're calling adaptive optics. So they've created some secondary mirrors that will be flexible and computer controlled actuators that will do, 100 corrections per second to try to correct the blurred light. And here's the best part. The telescope will use 6 laser beams to produce artificial stars in the sky to help calibrate these adaptive optics.
Yeah, so what they do is you need, in order to calibrate it, a known light source that is very, very stable, and then you shine it through the atmosphere, basically, and then you measure how much fluctuations there are, and then you try to correct your mirrors to bring that light source back into a perfect thing. And then presumably you've now corrected for the atmosphere. And we actually, it's a pretty well known technology that we use for a lot of different things. It's how they when they do laser tests to take out ballistic missiles. That's how they keep the lasers focused enough to take out ballistic missiles and stuff, is they have those types of mirrors and that are all fluxy and correct, and then they fire the laser into the mirror, and then that laser bouncing off the mirror will hit the target and destroy it. But I was back when they were still first starting to figure this all out, the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories was one of the first people to fire one of these off into the atmosphere, and they didn't really know what they were doing. All they knew was they were shooting a giant, super bright laser into the night sky, and so they sent out this warning to basically all the different airports and stuff around, and were like, yeah, so just so you know, we're firing this super bright laser into the night sky. You may not want to fly in this area at this time because we don't really know the consequences of that. And they got flooded by emails from the Defense Department and the Army and everybody were like, whoa, 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 whoa. You have a laser that you can shoot down airplanes with? We want one. Where did you get this?
Oh.
And they were like, no. We don't actually think it can take down a plane. This is just precaution. So they, unknowingly sent that information out. But yeah, it's interesting stuff. That's cool, man. I'm excited.
So there's another one. We're still going. This one's a wide-field infrared survey telescope that was donated to NASA by the National Renaissance Office, or the NRO, back in 2012. So they get ready to send this one up. So what it does is it can capture 100 times the area of sky that the Hubble can. But with single images, and these single images will contain over a million galaxies and will have close to the same resolving power as Hubble, thanks to, again, some of the adaptive optics and stuff like that. And, again, those adaptive optics are going to be used in space, which is like, get them extra, extra crisp, which is kind of crazy. So what they're going to be able to do with this one is measure the effects of dark energy, which, again, I didn't know that was a thing, but apparently it is. They'll be able to look at the expansion of the universe and the curvature of space-time with more accuracy than ever before.
Oh, man.
That just sounds awesome. There's some serious physics going on with this telescope.
Oh, yeah. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, they also think they'll be able to look at some exoplanet stuff and things like that. It's pretty crazy. And then there's the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, which probably is large. This one is also being done in Chile, and it's got an 8.4-meter primary mirror. Big deal. But it's like connected to a camera. It has a 3.2 gigapixel camera.
Ooh. It's a pretty big camera.
Yeah, so what's neat about this one is that it's designed to scan the entire southern hemisphere sky in just a few nights. Whoa. So, what that means is, or I should say, like, the one before it, it used to take, like, an entire year to get it. Like, yeah, we can do it in a couple nights now. And so they'll be able to see fast moving objects, obviously.
Right.
And they're like, yeah, we don't totally know what we're going to see, but maybe we'll see something. And let's see, it's going to start a 10-year survey that will take 1,000 pairs of exposures, accounting for 15 terabytes of data every single night, which is crazy.
Damn, that is so awesome.
This should make it perfect for capturing supernovas. And again, finding like near Earth objects that are moving or not moving, and maybe even find some of the things that we weren't looking for. And then there is this one's just nuts. It's the 500-meter aperture spherical radio telescope, or FAST. It's a single dish radio telescope. And this one was completed back in September. And I feel like this is what the James Bond movie is based off of, but maybe it's a different one.
It is a different one, but it's the same
concept.
Strategy.
Yeah. Just huge. It has... it'll be able to collect radio signals from super far away. It's already been contracted by the Breakthrough Listen Initiative to search for alien life. And we may not, but whatever, they're gonna try. And then there was another thing that they'll be able to do. Oh, there's something where they can track what they call a fast radio burst, and these come from all sorts of things, like a dwarf galaxy, or it could be from like a supermassive black hole injecting material, or a superluminous supernova, or perhaps even a magnetar. I don't know what those are. I'm just reading it. But they'll be able to track these things that were like, we think they happen, and be able to learn more about it. And yeah, those are all the telescopes. So it's one of those where like, they're pretty exciting. Oh yeah, I remember this was another one, which actually would be pretty cool, is we're planning on sending out some probes to Alpha Centauri, and they think they can do it in such a fat, which is like the closest galaxy that's not ours, I guess. Is that the way
right.
to say it?
No, and solar system.
Solar system, thank you. And the problem with a probe that gets that far away is that like it's hard to get information back to Earth. to tell us, like,
right,
did it make it? What did you see? Yeah. But they think that with this fast radio dish, they might be able to pick up its signal.
Oh, communicate nice. With
it. Or not communicate, nice. But at least listen to it.
Right.
Yeah. Which is pretty cool. So, like, telescopes, man. It's a big deal. It makes me want to go get a telescope and look at the night sky, I'll be honest. Oh, I wish I didn't live in a cloudy part of the world.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, dude, the technology is pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. You know what the craziest thing to me is? That we believe that most of the universe is composed of some form of matter that generates gravity, but doesn't interact with the gravitational, or doesn't interact with the magnetic field at all. It doesn't produce light, it doesn't block light, it just doesn't, light doesn't exist to us. And so, like, we spend all this money on things that allow us to go look out and sense the electromagnetic radiation spectrum, and most of the universe doesn't actually interact with it. It's crazy. Huh. That's what happens when your eyes are, that's how you sense the world. That particular force. Right. Interesting stuff, man. Interesting stuff. But you want to know what we're going to learn about the breakthroughs that they discover with this these telescopes, James, in the future?
Twitter?
Probably not Twitter. Maybe Twitter. I don't know. It depends. Depends on how Jack Dorsey does. Probably not LinkedIn. Maybe Snapchat if they get their way. But most likely, it'll be the Facebook.
Oh, yeah.
The 100-pound gorilla. Or no.
Is that right? I feel like it's now the 1.8 billion-pound gorilla.
Yeah, I was going to say, and let's be honest, a 100-pound gorilla is not that scary.
I don't know. You know, it depends on how active and fast it is and how violent it is. I might be afraid of a 100-pound gorilla. I mean, like, if there was a 100-pound dog that was coming after
that's
me...
That's a good point.
Like, I'd think twice, you know?
That would be
terrifying. I would be like, oh, no big deal, you're just 100 pounds.
Yeah, you know what? You're absolutely right. But a 100-pound gorilla, it would look cute until it started to pull your arms off, because it'd be 100 pounds of muscle.
Yeah, until I saw its fangs, and I'd be like, oh, boy.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You're a vicious wild animal. Why do we have you in the room with us? So anyways, Facebook had a, so Mark Zuckerberg this week published a 5,000-word essay, letter, rambling.
No, 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 no. 5,800-word.
Ah, okay. So nearly 6,000 words.
Huge.
Which, well, it is huge, except it's 500 words per page. No, 12 pages, it's not... It's not actually that long. I mean, it's an essay. It's not like he wrote a small book. I don't know. Anyway,
memo.
It's not a memo. I will say this. I didn't read it because it was too long.
Wait. So if it's 500, so what is it? It's 5,800 words divided by 500. That's 11. Call it 12 pages. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's a college paper. All right, I'm with you.
Yeah, exactly. It's not nuts.
I mean, it's a lot. Like, that's a project. You don't just bust it out in a weekend.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, editing that takes a couple hours.
He didn't edit it. Just get...
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I didn't say he edited it. I said somebody.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But he, yeah, so he wrote this, he wrote it, and it's hard to tell what exactly he was doing with it, to be honest, because it's so long. But he, this is the idea. For years, the mission statement of Facebook was often repeated and simple and concise. It was to give people the power to share and make the world more open and connected. And it's still their mission, according to their webpage. CEO Mark Zuckerberg acknowledged the severe shortcomings and blind spots the company's mission created. So he basically said, in times like these, Zuckerberg wrote, the most important thing we at Facebook can do is develop a social infrastructure to give people the power to build a global community that works for all of us. and those are a bunch of words that he doesn't actually go into. He uses social infrastructure a lot and never really explains what social infrastructure is, what exactly he means with this. There we go. He mentioned social infrastructure 14 times without ever quite describing what that is. But at a high level, he writes, he has 5 goals to help users build communities that are supportive, that are safe, that are informed, that are civically engaged, and that are inclusive. For the past decade, Facebook has focused on connecting family, friends and family, Zuckerberg writes. With that foundation, our next focus will be developing the social infrastructure for community. And safe, supportive, and inclusive communities should be table stakes for any social networking app, is what this writer writes. And Facebook has arguably done better on those fronts than many of its peers. Still has plenty to do. So this is kind of...
This is an interesting article by this writer. You can tell he doesn't really like Facebook.
Yep. Yeah. We don't talk politics on this show very often, but The Verge, they are loud and proud with their politics, man. They are.
Yeah, I mean, it's like his last thought is, I'm glad Facebook will now assume some responsibility for the effects its platform is having on the world, but I will never stop asking what might have been had it taken responsibility sooner. Like, dang, dude, just take a chill pill.
So I think the idea here, though, and this seems to be the general consensus, is that back at the end of the election, when fake news was becoming a topic of conversation for the first time, and specifically the idea of like wholesale fake news, where a headline, an article would be written, fabricated completely out of nothing. It would be published on a website that didn't do anything but this. They did no research, no journalism. They just made up headlines. And then they would publish it to Facebook. And the goal was to get clickbait titles that would get clicks, get links, and make money. We've talked about this on the show before. And these articles would spread like wildfire through Facebook. And importantly, I think it was a huge number, but it was like 20 or 30% of articles that were being passed around for conservative viewers were like were considered fake news, and then like it was like 15 or 18% were it was a little more than half were fake news with a liberal bent.
Wow.
And either conservative news was either pro-Trump or anti-Hillary, and then liberal news was the inverse. So the idea being that it had more of an effect on the conservative side, but it was just bad for everybody. And Facebook, Mark especially, when it first kind of started the conversation, their first response was like, complete, like, look, we are not involved in this. This isn't our fault. Like, these are people sharing this information. We don't have control over what they share. We don't have any responsibility here. Which,
yeah,
kind of on its face, it's like, well, your whole algorithmic newsfeed would suggest you have at least some responsibility in what news articles get passed where.
Totally.
And if people are making their voting decisions based on wholesale fabricated lies, then yeah, I'd say that you at least have some impact. And with 1.9 billion users, it's not hard to argue that Facebook is the largest newsstand on Earth, if not the largest newspaper. And that's where this gets really complicated, because we don't judge newsstands for having, if a newsstand has a bunch of magazines, they got the Daily Mail right next to the New York Times, we don't criticize the newsstand for having that. But if the New York Times were to publish a Daily Mail article, we'd criticize the New York Times for that. Like, one lies, the other one isn't supposed to.
Right.
And so where does Facebook's responsibility in, are they a newsstand or are they a newspaper? Does putting it on Facebook give credibility to it that it doesn't deserve? And is that their fault? And Facebook early on was like hardcore, nope, not our fault, we're not involved. And I think what this manifesto is sort of an acknowledgement of the fact that not even necessarily, he's very intentional in skirting around any talk of the election, which I think was smart from a business perspective, because they're not dumb. They realize that they're a global platform, not only are they a global platform, but they're a platform for all Americans. They don't want to be the place that only Democrats go to or only Republicans go to. They want to be the place that everybody can go to. So they have to be careful not to piss off an entire section of our political society. And, you know, just from a business perspective, that's super necessary. So he's being very careful to sidestep that. At the same time, it's undeniable that as newspapers, local newspapers have closed, whether in Colorado or Oregon or Washington or wherever, we watch civil engagement in those communities slow down. We get more and more focused on national politics that we have less ability to affect, and we pay less and less attention to local politics where people can actually be engaged and do something about it. And it has this weird effect of just what you pay attention, because what you pay attention to, you can't affect, you don't get engaged. And Zuckerberg is arguing for, look, I think we can actually do something here to increase civil engagement, to increase communities that are better communities for people. And it's weird because it's, I think one of my biggest problems with it is like his original, the mission statement of Facebook has always been so clear cut. It's easy to understand what they're trying to do and how they're trying to do it. And this sort of expands on that in an unclear way. it needs a bit more focus, Mark. Maybe I'd say somewhere in the ballpark of 5,750 less words would probably be a good place to start. You know, just give us something we can sink our teeth into, a simple idea of what it is you're trying to build. And I guess he would probably make the argument of, look, our mission statement's the same because it should be the same. This is just where I'm adding to it. I'm nuancing it. I don't know. It's an interesting dilemma that Facebook is being faced with, and it reminds me of when they were doing they were running experiments testing if they could affect the emotions of their users by how they ran their news feed. And there were really appalled people. So you can't subject people to these sorts of tests unknowingly. That's just completely unfair. And Facebook's argument was, look, we do this to people. We affect their well-being. Now, we can either do that blindly, or we can run tests and actually try to figure it out, how we affect people, and then we can at least pretend to do it responsibly because we're not doing it blindly. And it was, as far as they were concerned, it was an acknowledgement of what is, as opposed to a trying to become something they're not. And I think in a similar way, this is an acknowledgement of what Facebook has become, which is the world's largest newsstand, as opposed to, or a newspaper, however you want to define it. And them trying to figure out what to do about it.
I have a feeling that his expectations are even grander than that.
President? He wants to be president.
Well, it's funny. I mean, people have talked about that, right? He wants to be president. Right. But I think after reading this, you go, no, he wants something better than that even. He doesn't just want the United States for 4 to 8 years.
Yep.
You know, it's funny, like, he gives part of his thing is he gives a little history of humanity, and he talks about how one of the big differentiating factors between humans and other creatures, and this is what he believes, let's just put it out there, and where he's coming from, is it's our ability to organize and hold shared beliefs. And it doesn't matter if those shared beliefs are real or fake. The important part is that they're shared. And so he talks about how what we've been able to do is go from small groups to, you know, bigger ones. And there have been a couple different structures that have enabled that. Families, obviously, were kind of like the nucleus, the start of it. Governments have been a big one. And because they literally, like, they write the rules, like, here's what's expected, here's what's thought. But then there's an even bigger, more pervasive one that is probably a better analogy for what he's talking about, and that's religious organizations. Because they're formed on this shared belief and shared understanding and shared expectations. And some of them span governments and countries and ethnicities. And so when Zuckerberg, like, some of the stuff he starts talking about is, we want to become that. And one of the things that can break down a community is when you have splintered beliefs, which is exactly what what you were just talking about on Facebook. And so they've recognized this problem. And I forget what it was, but apparently there's some author that he's, like, really big into who is into this concept. And you can read a lot of this guy's work in Zuckerberg's letter going, yeah, okay, he's thinking about it. And so that's part of what Zuckerberg has identified as an issue is, we could lose everything if we splinter our beliefs. And so he now has this drive to say, we want to bring communities together and we want to do it in a positive, uplifting, civic oriented way, whatever. And no one really quite knows where he wants to head with this, but to be able to say, like, we want to get civil involvement again, like, you get this sense that he's thinking beyond just get out and vote.
Oh yeah.
And from a community standpoint, he's one of the biggest now.
Right. You
know? And so, it's pretty interesting. And so, it's funny. I actually, I was curious, and at the end of the day, I don't think this is true, but I went on and just went, what are the marks of the beast again? And, because you get this... Because you get this sense of, like, you know, he wants to be some sort of supreme ruler in charge of it all type of guy. Because, you know, you could see where he could pull people together and say, guys, we're not going to use currency on Facebook. We're going to share. We're going to work on projects together as a big group. We're going to have this global direction, you know, on, like, Star Trek-esque, if you will. Like, you could do that kind of stuff.
All I'm going to say is this. Nobody can write a 6,000-word rambling manifesto without kind of sounding like a crazy person. You just, even if you're not a crazy person, you're going to come off as a crazy person for doing it. It just doesn't work.
Like Jerry Maguire, like... Good job. He's out here in 6 months.
Exactly. Yeah. I think it's the fact that I don't know. Maybe this has been my attitude for the last, well, probably going on 6 years now. I've just been kind of like you know what? I'm going to try to worry about it less because I honestly would say this. I think Mark Zuckerberg,
go ahead. Is crazy. We're being sensational right now.
I know.
Which is what he warns against.
I think Mark Zuckerberg is an engineer, and he looks at at social problems like they're engineering problems. And what's amazing is how oftentimes he finds social solutions through good engineering practices. And
dude, right?
The perfect example of that would be how to maintain communication with your friends and figure out who's dating who. Build Facebook. I mean, he's just, it's the sort of thing he does, is how can I use technology to solve social issues? And I think what he's basically said was there was this one giant social issue, which was, how do we build communities and connect people? And we solved that problem to a growing degree. And then the next problem is, now that we've solved the communication problem, how do we solve the next problem, which is a splintering problem, an information problem, information that gets passed around that shouldn't. And one of the interesting parts about it is there's a really good Atlantic article that I probably, one of the things that I really like is there's an Atlantic article that we'll connect to, on the website. Which one's Mark liked the Fourth Estate is what I called it. but this idea of like, what does this mean from a practical perspective? Like, what is Facebook going to do? And the Atlantic writes this really long article about like how it's the end of journalism, and
really,
because there's this, yeah, because one of the things that they get into is that if you look at the history of journalism, how they made money, how they organize it, what is the organization, and basically this idea that the newspapers really started to be, the first major blow against newspapers was Craigslist. When Craig Newark started Craigslist, people stopped putting, what are those? Not wanted,
ads.
But... personal ads in the newspapers, and that dried up a huge revenue
stream. Dude, people used to list their properties in the newspaper. Can you believe that craziness?
I know, it's nuts. The classified ads, that's the word. And you know, so newspapers then had to move on to courting, instead of having a large piece of their revenue come from individual ad sales, it had become exclusively giant corporations, which is difficult. It starts to make it very small for local newspapers with a small circulation to survive when they have to survive on giant brands coming in buying ads. And so you started to watch that.
Yeah, like me, like I'm okay if only 1,000 people see it, so I'd pay it. And it's my only source. Like big brands, that's not the case.
And then Facebook and Google come along, and then they personally take a huge amount of the ad revenue because they own then the newspapers, at least they owned the platform and the content, right? So when you bought an ad through a newspaper, they got all the money for that ad.
Well, totally.
Now that Facebook has become a bit of a newspaper and Google has become a bit of a newspaper, they're the platform. You're just the content, so they'll pay you for the content. Well, newspapers, a big part of the cheap part was the paper. The expensive part were the journalists. And the paper paid for the journalists, the platform paid for the content, but the expensive part, what made the paper valuable, was the content. And so we're watching this issue where journalists can't afford to continue to do what they did and get really good journalism. And then on top of it, there becomes this even more problematic dilemma for Facebook that we touched on earlier, that they don't want to become one-sided politically. They want to service everybody. They want to do it safely. They want to do it fairly. They want to do it in a civically responsible way, but they definitely don't want to if there are news sources that are liberal or conservative, which some might argue you can't get away from that existing, how do they balance that? Do they hire liberal and conservative news editors to try to do it? Well, and Facebook's answer is like, no, that's just how you add. That's how you introduce more bias. No, you have a computer do it. You come up with an engineering solution, and you use the wisdom of the crowd and individual people. And to which the author of the Atlantic article goes on to say that, yeah, no, that's exactly how you destroy that's exactly how you destroy journalism even further, because then it's like news, you know, you're getting rid of this, it's that very desire that leads, that makes it even more difficult for journalists to do things that aren't clickbaity, that aren't, you know, you want to write the headline that's going to get viral, sensational, you know, moves. And even if Facebook insists that they don't want to do that, it's like part of the journalistic integrity wasn't just journalists. It was the editors. It was the person in charge of deciding what articles get published, what articles get on the front page, what articles get on the last page. And one of the interesting things I've seen there's a couple of guys that I listen to that one of their big arguments is that bias in the media doesn't come from reporting falsehoods. Bias in the media comes from what they don't report, because you can't necessarily attack Fox News, like Fox News, not their opinion people, but the actual news stuff. They don't report false information. What they do is they don't report negative information for their bias. Right. And the same can be said of MSNBC. MSNBC is there when they talk about stuff, they're very fair, from, you know, not their opinion stuff, but their news stuff. It's very fair. It's what they don't talk about that is where you can really see their bias. And so that's what the question becomes, is it's like, where is the bias going to be? There is going to be a bias. And or in your attempt to not have a bias, you'll let too much stuff through that's fake and clickbaity, and which is exactly where Facebook is.
You're giving
is right
up
now.
That bias to someone else, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. And they're able to take a hands-off approach to it all and be like, well, it's not our fault. Which is really where we come back to this whole, what got us, why Facebook is in this dilemma in the first place. Because in their attempt to not be biased, they've stepped back and said, well, it's not our fault. Don't get angry at us. Like, you know, it's your fault. You people did this. You're the ones who shared
that
these stupid articles.
Works, by the way.
I know. Yeah. And that's why, honestly, I think that's why Zuckerberg wrote this, because it's not, they believe that's how it should be, but what they've acknowledged is that's not how it is. How it is they're the ones being blamed for the dissemination of fake news, and consequently the, you know, right, whatever effect it has on our politics, if they're spreading it, they're, you know, responsible. And I tend to fall into the camp of, we get the government we deserve, we get the Facebook we deserve. we did this to ourselves. Like, Facebook can't fix it if we as a population don't want something different. Now, Facebook can help move it in a couple of directions. They're part of the community as much as the community is part of the community. But, yeah, I don't know. Interesting stuff, man. It's a hard problem that they're trying to fix. I'll admit it.
Do you think they'll pull it off? Or do you think it's just a bunch of words that aren't really actionable, and they'll just continue connecting people, and they'll make some small algorithm changes and call it a day?
What I really hope they do, and I think this would be awesome, is, and part of what he said definitely suggests that this is the direction they're going to go, is focusing on trying to give a platform for localities again. Basically say, look, we are part of the reason why local newspapers have collapsed, and local newspapers were a major, national newspapers, national TV, national radio, that still exists, that thrives. There are options to find out what's going on nationally, but locally, right, there's not really a platform. Those platforms are going away. So if they figure out, if they change their algorithm to allow people to learn more about their local cities and states, and that I think that could have a huge effect, and a huge positive effect. And it's something that they can do just by messing with the algorithm, you know? And
that'd be good, because I follow my local newspaper on Twitter, and I don't like their editor.
Yeah.
So the stories they choose to run, I'm like, why? I don't know.
Yeah.
But if Facebook could figure out what articles I like from that, from the one or two newspapers in the area, and just show me those, that'd be awesome.
Yeah. And allow, you know, and if it's one of those things where, you know, if you're going to blog about politics, you're going to blog about the national politics, because that's the only platform we have. That's the only shared community that we have to get an audience. But if all of a sudden you know that you're going to get a preference because you write an article about Los Gatos, California, as opposed to writing about Washington, D.C., then if you know as a writer you're going to get that preference, you're going to choose to do that because that's where you're going to get your audience. And I, like I said, I think that can be that could have a major healthy effect for not just our community but global communities. And that's kind of why I sit back and I sit there and I'm not that worried about Mark trying to become the hegemony of Earth, because the hegemon of Earth, because he, I don't think that's what he's trying to do necessarily. I think he's trying to say, how can we make more money with Facebook by better serving communities?
That's too simple.
I know, right? So I hate it when I do that.
I prefer the guy who's going for the power grab. He sees an opportunity, he's going for it.
It's more exciting, I'll admit. Mine's a little bit boring, but yeah.
I just like to think that he's built his own personal Jarvis. He's feeling a little Tony Starkish and is like, yeah, I could take over the world. Why not?
Yeah, man, he's on his way. He's Tony Stark's the good guy, James. Unless he's starring he's starring in a movie about Captain America, in which case he's kind of the bad guy, he's kind of the friend. It's hard to tell.
Exactly. That's how I feel about Mark. Keep him at arm's length. You never know where that guy. yeah, super true. So what's interesting, though, is that even though we're all like, Facebook's going to stick around, and it's just a question now of how big is it going to get, there's another property out there that's kind of going through the opposite right now, and that's Wikipedia.
Yeah.
There's an interesting article by Andrea James on Boing Boing, which has a really weird picture, which is probably related to the article that she wrote. But apparently, she wrote this, she made a contribution, I guess is the way to say it, to Wikipedia, because she saw on her, on Wikipedia that it was on a list of missing articles about the hemovanadin. It's apparently an innocuous article about, it's like a sea urchin type of thingy, coral thing.
I'll take your word for it.
Yeah. Anyways, so she wrote at least the beginning part of it. She was like, all right, this needs to be written. Sure, I'm in. Did the research and created a little article that had four references to published works like the Journal of Microscopy Research and Technique. And essentially said that hemovanadin is used to refer to the pale green vanabin proteins found in the blood cells called vanadocytes of ascidians, or sea squirts, and other organisms. It is one of the few known vanadium-containing proteins. German chemist Martin Hens first detected vanadium in ascidians in 1911. It's a real page turner. Unlike hemocyan and hemogoblin, hemovanadin is not an oxygen carrier. And then the references. So she wrote that for some reason. So, and she says there are, like, that's just an example of some of the obscure articles that make Wikipedia great. You know, right. I don't know about you, but if there's like, wait, what is this word? And if it's beyond just the quick definition, I'm like, no, I want to know what this word means. Like, Wikipedia is perfect for it. And this would be an example of that. Yeah.
I use it all the time.
Well, it turned out that at some point, someone replaced the entire article with a copy and paste text from a book that triggered a bot to flag the article as a copyright violation. Oops. That in turn prompted an editor, who she calls out as KDS44444, to log the article for speedy deletion without bothering to check the article history. This in turn prompted yet another user, H. Harworth, to delete the article, thereby scrubbing any edit history of the article and making it look as if she was one of the infringing authors to this article.
That's infuriating.
Yeah, and so she goes, so what's the big deal? Who cares if one little sea squirt on the reef gets destroyed? She goes, I care. She goes, but not enough to re-engage with Wikipedia's deletionists. And so she's like, this has happened to her a couple times, and now she's done.
That's not
by the way, she goes, she's written a couple thousand articles and made 50,000 edits because she believed in Wikipedia. This isn't like every once in a while.
Right.
And I've heard more than one story where it has become increasingly, what's the word for it? Where it's this core group that gets smaller and smaller and more insular. Thank you. And, yeah. And this is something that's driving people away because, obviously, there's a lot of moving pieces, and I get on one level why the person was like, oh, yeah, clearly. But then was lazy and didn't go back and double check it. And there's, you know, and I guess she could have fought it somehow, but it's just not worth it, apparently.
Yeah.
Super frustrating. Wikipedia could be in trouble, man.
I think it is. Honestly, I think the problem that Wikipedia is going to run into is that it's like, as long as they got money to keep the servers on, they'll be okay for a long time. But it's, if they, what's going to, the cycle that you run into is that more and more authors and editors are getting disenfranchised by the process. They have no ability and no recourse to fight it. And a small group of power users are becoming more and more influential, and they know how you and I use Wikipedia. Wikipedia is the source of truth for an enormous number of people, and not just on questions of hemoglobin, but questions of, you know, what bills did this senator sponsor, and what sort of controversies are they involved in, and, you know, and what they've realized is that if you can control the narrative, if you can control information on whether it's, if you can control the facts on all sorts of different topics, then you can control the conversation. They realized how powerful a position it is to be a unquestioned editor on Wikipedia. And not only does it give you power, but it gives you financial ties. I mean, there are stories galore about editors who this is how they make their living. They're power users on Wikipedia, and they get paid to do stuff. And the problem is that if there's enough of a slowdown, you know, as long as there's nothing else to replace Wikipedia, then,
yeah, which,
you know,
there isn't really.
Right. Yeah, we say ish. But as long as there's nothing to replace Wikipedia, then the editors are what keep the whole thing moving. You know, keep it moving, keep it growing, keep it as new things become questions, as articles, new articles need to be written, as new politicians become politicians. And the editors are what keep Wikipedia alive and keep the momentum of people going to it, which keeps the momentum of donations, which keeps the lights turned on.
Which, you know, like, you got to know that Google has pointed their AI learning machine at this.
That's what said, I was going to say.
Can we somehow scrape the entire internet to come up with that same summary or better?
Then this is the important part, James. Why not just download Wikipedia, which is what they've done, and start there? Build an AI and you train your AI to look for articles, start with an article of Wikipedia, follow the links, find information, and rebuild that Wikipedia page in reverse, basically, and train an AI to try to build, like you said, new Wikipedia pages by just surfing the internet. Especially because one of the important parts of Wikipedia is that it's well-referenced. You can't have something that's not well-referenced. So it's like, as far as Google's concerned, they're like, well, right now, Wikipedia works as a source of aggregated knowledge for us. But it doesn't stop being that. And we can just, as we build up our knowledge graph, we'll use it as one of the nodes in one of the frameworks for how to rebuild a Wikipedia page. Because as far as they're concerned, that's what the knowledge graph can be, right? If totally. An AI is sufficiently smart and has sufficiently... If it has links to all of the same links that Wikipedia has, and an AI is smart enough, it should be able to rebuild any Wikipedia page on demand as these links grow. You know, to some degree, what Google's goal has always been is to become Wikipedia and to become just a source of knowledge, and where you type in a question and it'll just give you all the information you want and a list of links of where you can go and find more. And the thing is, for Wikipedia and why it's so hard for them is that this is what Google wants to do, but it's also what Microsoft wants to do, and it's also what Facebook wants to do, and it's also what there's a whole list of companies that are like, yeah, that's kind of where we hope we go with this whole AI thing,
right?
That's the end goal. So it becomes this issue of not only is it bad news for Wikipedia, but it's an inevitability that, you know, what they're realizing is that human curation allowed them to basically jumpstart past AI. But it has flaws that are really, it has big flaws. I think that just, I don't know. I think the worst part about it is that the Wikipedia Foundation, the guys that actually run the servers, Jimmy Wales, they don't do a lot to try to fight this because it's a monster to them. And I think that, like, unlike Reddit, which has the admins have this like dictatorial control over the mods to some degree, you know, they understand that the moderators make the website what it is, but the admins will step in and rewrite rules and do stuff that they probably shouldn't do for the health of the community. Whereas Wikipedia has the opposite problem, where like the moderators, the editors, the authors, they have so much power, and the foundation, the administrators of Wikipedia are like, whatever, we just keep the lights on.
Yeah, it's all you get the sense like they're just happy when they hit their funding goals for the year.
Yeah. Which, you know, I understand that. I understand why that's it's tough, man. Tough place to be for the Wikipedia.
Wonder. I like what you said. Wikipedia was a great solution in the pre-artificial intelligence age.
Yeah.
And as we're headed there, I mean, we talked about things like Watson, where it consumes all this information and then can spit out an intelligent answer back to you.
Exactly.
Like, dude, that's Wikipedia. And,
right.
And it just hasn't been... Yeah, and that's happening.
Why would you need medical articles in Wikipedia when you have Watson? And the best part is that not only will you have Watson, but you'll also have OK Google and whatever Amazon's doing and whatever Microsoft's doing.
Yeah.
And whatever, you know, you'll have multiple sources of these knowledge congregators, and Wikipedia will just be one of those, and it will be biased by its editors. So either they figure that out, or the fact that it's written entirely by people won't save them.
Well, and what's really going to hurt them is when Google decides that someone else is a better source.
Yep. Yeah.
And then page views dry up and they're just dunskies.
Yeah. When you type in some weird idea, it doesn't hit. Because right now, when you get like a knowledge graph thing where it's like the first result has all that little blurb, it's usually the first couple of sentences of Wikipedia.
Right.
And once that stops being the case, which in a lot of places it is, like if you ask weird questions, a lot of times it'll have, you know, it'll have five or six different answers. They're not from Wikipedia, or not always from Wikipedia. I don't know. It's interesting to see where it'll go, man. All I know is I'm gonna be downloading Wikipedia pages with my unlimited Verizon data plan. Yay! Probably not.
About time.
I know. This is an interesting week for the mobile internet companies, the telecoms, Verizon, AT&T, and Sprint all introduced unlimited data plans.
Dude, don't you love
real competition?
No. Cartels.
Right. Oh, yeah. Okay, actually, that's a really good point. It's funny. I read a lot of articles about it, and a lot of people suggested that this was price fixing. But I actually tend to go the other direction. I think what happened was T-Mobile has been growing at 100% plus growth rates for quite a few quarters. They're really, really starting to expand, and Verizon isn't seeing similar growth. And what they've decided is that, you know, even though we're growing and it's hard, you know, Verizon's never going to double their user base in a quarter because they're the largest provider. But they're not growing as many humans as T-Mobile is. And there is a concern that T-Mobile is not only are people joining T-Mobile that would otherwise go to Verizon, but they're going to T-Mobile and like people are leaving Verizon and going to T-Mobile. Like the growth is I think it's become clear that it's an issue. And more importantly, T-Mobile has figured out how to make the finances of unlimited data work. And what they've shown is that it's a sustainable model and it attracts users. And T-Mobile's done a couple of things that getting rid of the 2-year contracts. Everybody's jumping on board with that. Getting, you know, you buy your subsidized phone separately. You basically take a loan out. Like, everybody got on board with that. Like, T-Mobile has been shaking it up, and the other carriers have been following. Verizon,
dude, you're so biased. You got a little love thing going with them, don't you?
Well, you know, they're my carrier. I like the T-Mo, man. I'm somebody who, you know, everybody, all of these companies, somewhere between 20 and 30 gigabytes per month, they actually start to throttle your internet speed, which upsets people because it's not truly unlimited.
Dude, whatever.
Which I'm like, I get why that is upsetting because it's called unlimited. I get where you're coming from. At the same time,
just have to get over it. I'm gonna say, it's a branding term, not a description.
It's so much better, and it's sufficient for me, so I'm okay with, you know, I'm okay with.
How many gigs do you use a month, by the way? Do you know that off the top of your head?
Between 10 and 20. I'm never less than 10. I'm never over 20.
Wow. Okay. I'm like,
you know,
never over 3.
Well, yeah, but that's because, you know, you can't be. I can be.
Yeah, but I don't try to hold back.
I can download entire movies. The worst part is for me, most of the time, my T-Mobile is faster than my Wi-Fi. So if I'm at work and I want to do literally anything, I want to be on my phone. I don't want to be connected to Wi-Fi because it's slower. So watching YouTube videos on my break or not on my break, I'm going to watch it over T-Mobile. I'm going to download podcasts. I'm going to download it over.
Does that include tethering, by the way?
So my T-Mobile allows, I think it's 5 gigs of tethering. Verizon does like 10 gigs of tethering. AT&T's new unlimited plan doesn't have tethering. I don't know where Sprint's at. Nobody cares where Sprint's at. They're whatever.
Yeah, who cares?
Disappointment. They disappoint.
Because that would be my use case. Would be like if I'm doing like a rehab thing and I'm at a property. Usually, what I do is I get Comcast temporarily while I'm there, and so the question would be, could I just tether it to my computer and then cool, I'm good to go. You know.
Well, if you're not using more than 3 gigs a month, then yes, we're pretty good.
I feel like I am.
The reason why I'm sticking with T-Mobile, even though Verizon has a better network, is because right now I have unlimited data in China as part of my T-Mobile plan. Verizon and AT&T aren't going to offer that because of people like me who continue to use the internet. And obviously I'm not using I'm not downloading like YouTube videos and stuff, so I'm not quite as bad, but as I normally would be, but it's still a lot.
That's just because it's slow.
Exactly. but it's way more expensive for T-Mobile because they have to buy data in mass from local carriers. And oh man, you guys, why did you let me do this? This is your fault, T-Mobile. but yeah, no, I'm buying into this is a classic example of competition at work. And as soon as Verizon did it, the reason why T-Mobile and or why AT&T and Sprint jumped is because they all kind of knew that they were colluding. Nobody else was offering it, so nobody else was going to offer it. And then as soon as Verizon decided, hey, you know, T-Mobile's, it's working, we're going to just copy their plan and stop the bleeding. As soon as they did that, then AT&T and Sprint had to jump too. I guess the definition of competition, right? It, you come in, you shake up the market. That's why I like it,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, it works. It just takes a little longer than what we would like it to be.
Yeah, well, you know, hey, start your own wireless company, James, if you want it to go faster, huh? That's the capitalist way.
Yeah, I've watched Google try that, and I'm good.
I know. But, yeah. That's all I got on that.
So, I mentioned Watson a little bit ago, and there's some other stuff going on in that realm. So super cool, actually. There's this this engineer working in his basement, and his son came and was checking out the project, and his dad was like, "Yeah, we got this this thing. It's called Watson, and we're putting it smarts to help fight cybersecurity. So what it can do is look at a network and kind of tell you what, you know, what's going on. And then you can type commands back to it and ask it questions and stuff like that. It's like IM, essentially." And his son goes, "Well, why can't you talk to it?" Awesome. And so the engineer, Spiziak, something like that, he's like, "Well, that's a great question. Let's build that." And so they literally bought like a little Raspberry Pi and a little touchscreen, and They built it.
That's
and
awesome.
Him and his son worked together. Super fun. They used some pre-existing bits of code and gave it some basic functionality. And I think they said it was like only a few hours to get it up and running, which is crazy. Man.
Technology is incredible.
And then, as they said, as weeks went by, Spizak found himself talking with the interface and was like, man, I started to feel like a weirdo. So they gave it like a logo, essentially, which is based off the Watson one, so they could look at it. And then they gave it a name, and the name they settled on was Haven, which they got from a baby naming website that means safe haven, essentially.
All right.
And so they're like, and we took the Y because it looks cool. So after a bit of time, this was around like Thanksgiving time, he felt good enough about it that he started showing it off to his IBM colleagues, and everyone was like, dude, this is actually kind of awesome. And so essentially what they're using it as now is, think of it like a second screen that acts like Alexa or Siri or the Google Assistant. And so you literally can ask it questions, be like, how's the security looking today? What are the big issues? And it will answer you back over voice. Like, yeah, it's pretty sweet. And so, because one of the cool things about like Watson and Haven is that it's like a supercomputer and it's multi-threaded and can do a lot of things at once. And right. So you can ask it to do something like, hey, can you just check every single security outlet? Or I don't know what I'm just saying, but you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, right. Yeah. Security stuff.
And
security things.
can you check all the knobs, make sure they're all locked.
Exactly.
And like, boom, done. We're good. And they say, yeah, on average, they have to deal with like 200,000 individual events every day. Like, oh, that's ridiculous. But
I know, that's a lot of events, man.
Yeah, and then report back, like, here are the important ones. Here's ones that are worth looking at. We didn't know what to do with this one. Something like that. But
that's so awesome.
Yeah, dude, right? Super cool.
That's really cool.
Yeah. Haven.
Say, I would say what I love about it is it's a couple of different AI technologies all bound together, right? It's you've got obviously machine learning for vocal commands and stuff, which is impressive and awesome and useful. But it's the, you know, we just sent it. We taught it how to do security. That part you kind of like, you know, as part of this conversation of what this thing is capable of doing, we kind of gloss over that they taught an AI that can do security for all of their stuff. Like, oh, it's just, man, artificial intelligence. What does the A stand for? I don't know. I'm impressed by this. I like it. I wanna get into it, man. Sweet. I've been thinking this week about, like,
you know, they got like an open API. Like, you can get into it. Apparently,
I know,
which is cool.
I want to train a neural network. I think when I get back home, I was looking up tutorials on
I know what you're talking about.
Your basics, your basic convolutional neural networks, as it were. CNNs,
yeah, the convoluted ones. Those are good.
Yeah, this is pretty good. I'm gonna try it out. See if I can. Get a little something. Oh, I you know, I can't believe we've made it this far into the podcast without me saying this. Guess what I bought yesterday?
3D printer?
Yep.
Oh, yeah!
Yeah.
Yeah, how did you not lead with that?
I forgot. I don't know.
I forgot.
It's, yeah, it should be...
So what'd you get?
I got the, the Monoprice Maker V2, and it's the I'm going based off of Engadget's recommendations. It is they describe it as the budget choice. It's basically of all your cheapest ones, it's the best of the cheapest. And the reason why it is the cheapest is because it doesn't do anything fancy other than print a 7x7x7
It's the Maker Select 3D Printer V2?
Yep, that one.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's like the I read a bunch of reviews and that doesn't actually have a great rating on Amazon for 3D printers, but that's and
8x8 by 7.
All right.
Huh.
But one of the big complaints about it is that it's kind of finicky if you're just like if you're going into it, and the complaint is like, oh, it's kind of hard to understand how to use, which is fair. Oh. It's not like a printer in the traditional sense where you hit print and the document prints and you don't worry about it. Like, no, it actually takes some manual calibration to get going at first. I know. And it takes some manual calibration, which can be really frustrating for people. And the software it doesn't have any specialized 3D software. You have to use some of the more
which you just so happen to have and are good at.
Well, yeah, exactly. This is the 3D printer that I borrowed to use the exact same software. So I already have the software all ready to go and set up. Like I'm just like reading through it. I was like, all of these complaints are complaints that I can deal with. And
that's cool.
And I get to save $400. Yeah, sign me up.
Yeah, this bad boy is only $318.
Yeah, it's not bad, man.
Plus the filament. So it does like what kind of printing is it?
Plastic printing, additive printing. You got to think of it. It's like a hot glue gun.
Okay.
Continuous feed hot glue gun is the easiest way to describe it. You know, it's not a. For what I want to do, it's perfect. Because
what is it you want to do?
Prototyping and jig building. Let's say you wanted to cut a dodecahedron out of wood. So a 12-sided die. To do that is with just like saws and stuff is very difficult to do. Like it take a bit of math and quite a bit of precision. Or you can 3D print a little jig that kind of holds everything at the right angle for you. And all of a sudden, it's a brain dead. Like it just does it for you. You don't have to worry about it. And that's what I want. I want things like that. I want to be able to create jigs the reason why this reminded me of it is there's a project that I'm working on that requires me to take a bunch of really high resolution, accurate pictures of a wooden sphere. And holding the sphere so that you can move it precisely and take pictures consistently every single time is really difficult unless you can print out like a little stand to do that for you. And doing it by hand is impossible. Doing it with a 3D printer and some rudimentary electronics is simple. So I don't know, and once you start to like imagine yourself with a 3D printer, like every problem becomes solvable with one. You're like, oh, I could just do this. And having actually used one, kind of understanding what the limitations of it are, I feel comfortable saying that, no, this is something I can use and find solutions for and I will enjoy it. So I pulled the trigger.
Dude, that's awesome.
I got that weird feeling in my stomach that I always get when I spend like more than $150 of like, this is probably a really bad idea. I'll regret forever.
I get the opposite. I'm like, we're going to do that again.
I am so glad that I don't. I'm actually so glad that I have as much. I'll tell you what, James, I was through my second pint last night when I was like, I'm never going to feel this willing to spend this money again. So I did it then.
That's funny. It's a drunk. Wow, interesting.
Each pint cost $3, so I was feeling like it was literally. I did the calculation, and I was like, "Wow, this is really cheap beer. This is kind of awesome. I got money, man. I got money for days." I had it all saved because I actually decided I was going to buy it before I left for China, but I didn't want it to come while I was in China, so I decided to wait till the very end of the trip, and. Yeah, pull the trigger.
And here you are at the end of the trip.
I know.
That's cool, man.
Excited. It should get to my house about 4 hours after I do, so that's cool. Of course,
wow.
The filament won't get there until Monday, and so I can't actually do anything with it, but that's probably fine. I'll have many sleepless nights in the coming weeks, so that'll be fun.
It doesn't even come with like a little samplet.
A samplet? Like a sample?
Yeah, just a little sample filament.
I don't... Too clever by half. No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I wouldn't...
Okay.
I really doubt it, man. This is like... This is a budget printer. You buy everything else yourself.
That's fair, dude. See, that's the name of the game, though. Ship it with a host. But not a lot. Just enough to get you used to it.
Exactly.
I know. We know how to. HPI knows how to play that game.
No matter how cheap it is,
we'll give you a little bit.
it's a really good point. that's funny. So yeah,
we'll see. That'll tell us how its prospects are for continuing on as a company.
Yeah, it's true. Well, yeah. Don't ask MakerBot though. They're not going to be pleased with my shopping decisions. They fired 30 people last, or 30% of their employees. This month, this week. They're pivoting, James. They're pivoting. Mm. And by pivoting, they realize that the only people that are buying stuff from them are teachers and engineers. So that's who they're going to try to target. So you're like, that's probably a good idea. But it doesn't require as big of a company to service those communities. So it is what it is.
True.
Anyways, I'm going to skip the Snapchat. Is Evan Spiegel compares Snapchat to Bell's telephone.
Whatever.
Especially that one, because that one got me mad.
In what way? It's old and outdated and no one uses it anymore? Is that what it means by that?
No, it means that it's Snapchat is like a camera company and it changed how people communicate in a fundamental way. Which, for reasons that we've gone over, is just not true. Whatever. I do think we should link this article because it's worth kind of going through, but it talks about how Snap Inc. will get to a $100 billion valuation after, like, what they'd have to do over the next 4 years to become a super valuable company. And it's actually, I would say this, it is definitely a viable roadmap. What he writes is not crazy. It will not happen, but it's definitely possible. it's a pretty good article, and then, but yeah, it's worth checking. Basically, his argument is they want to get into it, if they do what they've done is they've got a small but very engaged, a relatively small but relatively hyper engaged community, and it exists that way for decisions that they've made with their product that are unintuitive, like the ephemeral nature of the pictures and stuff like that, and just sort of and the reverse that stories is like newsfeed but in reverse order. These brilliant mind, you know, just paradigm shifting ideas. Then if they bring that sort of user experience to new platforms, and the first one to bring it to new platforms like VR and AR, they could position themselves to be a hardware company, a hardware software company that super serves these hyper engaged markets, and that would be worth $100 billion as a company. Which I'm like, yeah, that is totally true. Somebody is probably going to do that. I just don't think it's the Bell's telephone of social media apps that's going to do it.
Yeah. Hmm.
I just think it's more believable that a company like Facebook will somehow manage to crack that nut, or Google, or Apple,
yeah,
or Amazon, or Microsoft, or anybody else that wants to be doing it as well and has, you know, their superpowered engineering teams behind them. But
and has decided that not everyone wants things ephemeral.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. So one of those things, man. One of those things. It's just a. I still think they're going to be the. I think they're the next Twitter, man. They'll be around. They'll do stuff. They'll
oh, yeah.
be worth money. There's just no way they're going to be a juggernaut. Like, you're going to be really optimistic.
I agree, man. I mean, I'm there somewhere between Zanga and Twitter, in my opinion, or Groupon.
Yeah. Hey, you know, honestly, I'd love to be any one of those three, like a founder of any one of those right. three companies. Like, I got no hate for that. Those are. If I did that with my career, that'd be fantastic. I just really love the idea that that'll be a huge disappointment for Evan Spiegel that he's not, that that's all he ever becomes.
His biggest problem is he wants to be bigger than Facebook.
I know. And
as we talked about earlier today, that's not happening.
Right.
Facebook is going to the point now where they're like, dude, yeah, we've got a team focused on Snapchat and killing them, but like that's not our main focus anymore.
Right, right. Well, the thing it's funny because now that I'm actually like talking about this article out loud, it's obvious that basically what this guy was saying was if they can beat Facebook to the punch, Facebook's whole idea right now is that VR and AR are going to become the next platform of social engagement. And
totally.
And Facebook is, Mark Zuckerberg is, a huge amount of his attention is focused on that. How do we create a virtual environment for people to be engaged in? And basically what this guy was saying is, well, you know, if Snapchat can do that, then, you know, then they'll beat Facebook at it. Like, yeah, that's a really big if. and from a hardware perspective, the other thing that he said is like, you know, they'll come out with a Spectacles V2 in like 2020. You know, which is like this full-blown AR, VR headset or whatever. And I'm like...
That's cool.
That would be really cool.
It's way too late.
I was going to say, I have a feeling that Apple will have actually come out with their solution to AR by then. And, you know, if you want to be one of the apps on their platform, that's okay. You can do that.
Well, and Microsoft already has their HoloLens, and you know they're working on a low-profile version.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's... Yeah, they're yeah, jeez. Yeah, it's, you know, that it's a, I can't wait to see what happens, man. It's going to be a fun ride for them. but all right. I hate to do this, James, but I'm actually running out of time. I gotta catch a flight.
Well, that's cool, man. Yeah, we don't want you to miss your flight. That would be important. So, everybody, thank you for joining us, and thank you so much for listening to episode 282. We really do appreciate it. Don't forget, you can check out all the show notes and all the links at furloughbros.com. Again, episode 282. If you'd like to get those show notes sent directly to you, you can do that as well by signing up on the email. And finally, this podcast is supported by listeners just like you. So if you would also like to contribute, we have 4 different levels. We have fanboys, nerds, junkies, and mavens, and they all have their own levels of rewards. It's awesome. Again, you can check out furloughbros.com to find out how you too can become a patron. Alrighty, I am James Furlough, and my soon-to-be stateside brother is Matthew Furlough, and so we will talk next time.